I'm going to open the House Committee on Education Subcommittee on Education Innovation, and then I'm also opening the informational meeting today. Today is January 25th, and today the topic of our information is about assessments. I asked for this informational hearing because there are a number of assessments currently required through our current past legislation. And we have assessments that are required as part of the No Child Left Behind Act for federal use. But we also have assessments that are given to our students for a range of purposes and reasons. And I wanted people, the whole committee, to understand what's happening out in schools and as far as assessment. And that's really the focus. And today, I want to make a change in the agenda for the schedule of how people will be presenting, if it's all right with the presenters. We will start out with a presentation about English language learners, and then is it all right to do the ACT before we do SAT?
We'll go last.
Alphabetical.
And then Tessa's last. You okay, Doug? Well, we're all geared up. We have the sample ready here to take the test. Okay.
I'm ready to move on to the eighth grade.
Really stuck in the dead.
What did you suggest is the order?
English language learners, and then do the ACT presentation second, and then the SAT presentation third, and then the technology enhanced student assessment fourth. Okay. Committee's fine with that? The other thing that I'd like to remind us, there is a committee that meets here at 3 o'clock in this room. And so our target time to absolutely finish would be 2:50 so that we can get out the door and the other committee and their presenters to move into this room. So just remember that as your presentations go along. If I might say, you know, can we just have a summary? Please don't be offended because we do have logistics that everybody wants to be able to testify. So, and the only other reminder is make sure your cell phones are off. This is just such important information that it does interrupt our sound system, which is very sensitive. With that, it is my absolute pleasure. One of my colleagues from Woodburn School District is here. David Batista is our Director of Bilingual Education, and he has been asked to present on what do we do about literacy and following the federal guidelines for assessment for our English language learners. Thank you. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is David Bautista, as Representative Kahn mentioned. I'm a Director of Bilingual Services for Families and Students in Woodburn School District. I'm here to present the realities in terms of Woodburn School District. I'm not sure how much background you may need about Woodburn, but we are a mid-sized school district of 5,000, and we are number one with the number of Hispanics and English language learners. We have 3,700 Hispanics, and of those, nearly 3,000 are English language learners. We have a big population of Russian, so we have a program to serve Russian students. We have a K-12 Russian program for our students, and our families are extremely happy with the results they are having. Later on, I will explain how our students are doing. But this report, I will start with, it's a compilation of education research articles, education bipartisan reports, local information educators, and first-hand accounts. You have all those documents in a white binder. The compilation is provided to encourage an open discussion about the importance of having valid and reliable assessment information that will concern English language learners. It is our premise that English language learners should be seen as potential community, state, and national resource, as is portrayed in this report. The problem with language and culture around the world, not only in the United States, is sometimes is seen as a problem. Sometimes it's seen as a right. but we should be seeing it as a resource. And later on, with the reports, you're going to see that the importance of language and culture. It is now clear that the No Child Left Behind Act is having a major impact on the assessment of all students, especially English language learners. However, the unintended consequences are still far from being understood by many educational officials, some lawmakers, and many stakeholders. So, for example, this is a typical example that happened to us. Currently, with the development of English Language Proficiency Assessment, known as ELPA, little is known about how many districts and why they're failing. Last year, for example, it was reported in mid-December that the Woodburn School District had 73% of their students move from one level of English to the other. Later in late December, it was reported that because of a change in the calculations by the state, in the same district, only 53% pass. Well, obviously, the question from the superintendent to the bilingual director is, what are you doing? Obviously, from the families, from the community, David, is my children learning English? The first thing that any district, especially Woodburn, is that the first day that the child is enrolled in Woodburn School District, the child is learning English. That's the commitment. That's by law. We're binded by federal and state law to do that. We're funded by the state, and we have Title III monies to continue doing that professional development. So it is kind of interesting. Since the instruments used before the ELPA were not designed to appropriately measure growth, districts had to rely on teacher experience, student work, to know if students were advancing according to each district expectation. The use of language surveys by itself can't guarantee reliable information for teachers and administrators. It can only give a limited view of students' level of English or native language. As a result, we believe we have been relying on arbitrary achievement targets and invalid assessment. No Child Left Behind cannot make accurate determinations about school quality with these kind of practices. Having valid, reliable assessment information available to stakeholders, such as school administrators, teachers, and parents, provides such individuals the necessary information so they can make the needed improvements. In a functional accountability system, all children, regardless of color, level of English proficiency, socioeconomic status, or disability status, are ensured an education that prepares them to be successful, active, contributing members of our democratic society. For English language learners, the road to success has been riddled with obstacles for many reasons. Despite the U.S. Supreme Court decision Law versus Nichols in 1974, which requires school districts officials to address students' limited English proficiency so they may participate in the regular education program, and the subsequent law remedies or compliance standards for English language learners programs, many individuals are still unaware of successful educational practices for English language learners. As a consequence, many believe that English language learners are in bilingual programs, and therefore perceive bilingualism as responsible for delaying students' English acquisition. Far from reality, bilingual education programs are still already used in Oregon. Most of the students are totally immersed in some kind of English as a second language practice, while very few English language learners, students in the state, actually receive native language instruction. We're going to see an appendix where Superintendent Susan Castillo has the closing achievement gap, and last year she acknowledged 7 schools, and out of those schools, 4 were bilingual or using native language instruction, closing the achievement gap in minorities and English language learners. In looking at the linguistic and ethnic groups of Oregon, it is clear that Hispanics are the largest population of minorities. This particular group has low performance rate across grade levels and the highest dropout rate. The information comes directly from the statewide report card, and you have it there. In Appendix 2, the achievement gap of many remain constant despite the 10 years of historical data provided in the current state report card. 1993-94, the state of Oregon had a dropout rate of Hispanics of 16.2. Currently, 2004-05, it's only 8.5, 8.1. If we look at the data, Hispanics continue to have the highest dropout rate in the state despite the reduction of nearly 50%. In earning the CIM certificate of initial mastery, the Hispanic group is at the bottom with only 13.8% of students obtaining the regular diploma. For me, that's a sense of urgency, especially in Woodburn when I have 3,700 students, Hispanic descendant. In mathematics, multiple choice, 10th grade, appendix 3 and 4 in your appendix, the historical achievement gap continued to be 12% of Hispanics meeting standards, while 32% of the white population meet standards. In 10th grade reading, 2006, 21% Hispanics met standards, while 49% of white met standards. That's the achievement gap that we're talking about. That's 10th grade. They have two more years to graduate. They have one more year to begin to take what my colleagues are going to be talking about, the SAT. Looking at the 10th grade students by subgroup, the graph shows the percent of those students meeting reading and math standards in 2006. Only 12% of limited English proficient or ELL students are meeting. Well, they're limited in English. That is why they're not going to be proficient in English. They're 14% in math only. The trend is no different across all grade levels reported, which led us to question internally our districts, what is our instructional methods? What are we doing about curriculum? And what are we doing about assessment? That is why the importance of assessment. Many Oregon educators believe that ODE has a good opportunity to measure progress by using the growth model. This model has been used by the Oregon Department of Education for selecting and acknowledging schools for the results in closing the achievement gap. This past year, the four of the seven schools that were selected were using some kind of a native language instruction. For example, Phoenix Elementary in Phoenix, Oregon, being one of the first dual language programs implemented in the state, is doing pretty good up to date. Aloha Park Elementary in Beaverton attributed their student gains to the bilingual immersion program. Cecil Trust Elementary in Canada, having a strong native literacy component for English language learners at each grade level. And Nellie Muir in Woodburn, with 10 years of implementing bilingual bicultural education. And you can see, is the highest in minority, is the highest in English language learners, and the highest in socioeconomic disadvantaged students. The importance of native language assessments at third grade and the follow-up analysis of the same students' subsequent assessment results provides a clear picture of what is happening in the schools. And this was done very nicely by the growth model by ODE. With this kind of growth model, the state was able to follow the same students over time and, to use a simple phrase, be able to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. However, in order to provide a comprehensive picture of students and schools' performance, it is important to use multiple indicators of student achievement in addition to these tests. If teachers are not being considered, the message is that the only assessment that counts is the one mandated by the state or the federal government, and you only measure the federal government math and reading. In addition, a comprehensive program evaluation needs to be considered when evaluating student programs. The program evaluation plan that also you have in your appendix, it was developed by the top researchers in the nation, Dr. Virginia Collier and Dr. Wayne. They did a longitudinal study of the student performance in 3, 5, and they're going to do a 12-year revision of Woodburn data. This information will serve two purposes. One, to see if English language learners are actually closing the achievement gap, and second, for program evaluation. We need to continue providing professional development. Every single year, 30 to 40 teachers leave, and we have to prepare the ones that are coming. Hopefully, the universities are doing a better job in understanding the changes demographic in Oregon, so we don't have to use that money in professional development. Collier and Thomas conducted a national study for the Office of English Language Acquisition at the federal level, and the results were deemed as research-based. The findings from such national study demonstrate that in order to close the achievement gap, English language learners need to advance at a rate of 3 to 4 points per year in order to close that gap. If the program doesn't allow the student to grow at that pace, he or she will not close the achievement gap. In order to obtain the expected results, districts need to have a plan that entails a sound research-based program, resources for implementation, ongoing evaluation of the program, and make modifications based on what the evaluation is suggesting. Research as well as legislative initiatives are loud and clear when addressing the need for teachers who are knowledgeable in effective instruction of English language learners. Right now, Miller Bill H.R. 2835 of the 109th Congress speaks to the need of bilingual and English as second language teachers in cultural and language development in the U.S. When I look at the language resources available in our K-12 system, I strongly believe that we have a dual obligation providing a valid assessment and support for effective program development. It is imperative to continue to support the development of aligned assessments in order to provide a real picture of growth in English. Ensuring that all assessments are valid and reliable provide useful diagnostic information to improve teaching and learning. Equally important is to provide support to those districts or schools that understand the need for effective instruction for English language learners and students and want to develop what the Education for Global Leadership calls national flagship language institutions. The Foreign Language Assistance Program is already supporting Portland Public Schools in developing Chinese and Russian. Eugene has had a Japanese immersion program. Woodburn has developed K-12 Russian and Spanish program. Indeed, we are in the United States, and English is the most utilized language for business in the world. However, we need to understand that while the children outside the U.S. are adding English to their languages, they are already speaking. U.S. educators are not adding other languages to the English of our native-speaking students. Additionally, we are eliminating the native languages of students and replacing it with non-proficient English due to the shortcomings of English-only instruction. To emphasize the point, I'm not here to promote one model. I am here to talk about the need for adequate assessment that measure what they intend to measure, as well as look at effective programs for English language learners. District personnel must be well informed about student progress if they are to improve programs and achieve the goal of all students meeting benchmark standards. Without accurate data on students, linguistic and academic performance, educators cannot be well informed about the extent students are improving and whether or not district programs are actually accomplishing intended goals. As the population of ELLs continue to increase in Oregon, the need for valid and reliable assessment for this population becomes even more important. The reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind is coming, and we believe that our state can provide substantial assistance in creating such valid and reliable assessment for English language learners. I will attend any questions.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Kump. And I first like to thank Mr. Bautista for his testimony today and for your wonderful work helping unlock the potential of these English language learners. I doubt whether a conflict of interest disclosure is required for an informational meeting, but I feel obliged to give it anyway. My wife is an English language learner teacher at Gresham High School, and so I am hearing many of the same things from you that I've heard from her. I did want to sort of underscore and amplify a couple of things that you said. First of all, I think it's helpful, maybe everyone on the panel knows already, but when we talk about ELL, we're talking about what has historically been called ESL, mm-hmm. and this change denotes the fact, that, as I understand it, that many of the students who were teaching English in our public schools are learning English as not their second language, but in fact their third or their fourth language. In the case of my wife, she's teaching students from parts of Mexico where they've learned an indigenous language as their mother tongue and then Spanish in some primary education there and then English as students here. And maybe you can speak to some of the challenges that ELL students often face that make language acquisition particularly difficult. And I'm thinking of the fact that for many students, many of our ELL learners here, they don't have necessarily have literacy in their first language, and what that means for a student who enters the U.S. as a you know, as a 12-year-old or 13-year-old or 14-year-old without literacy in their mother tongue. How does that create additional challenges for those students here?
One of the things that we confront daily, the Woodburn School District created a welcome center where all families, regardless of all families, go through the welcome center. And right there we do the registration. And absolutely we begin to understand, for example, last year we saw 1,700 families. And we maintain our numbers of less than 5,000. That's the example. In doing so, we were able to see that absolutely, if they come from Eastern Europe, we thought, well, they're Russian, they go to the Russian program. Well, no, they are Ukrainian, they speak different language, they're Moldovan, they're Latvian. So it's not Russian only, but they're fine because they're saying, okay, I add a third, like you're mentioning, I add a third language. That's the case when they come literate in their first language, which they are adding English and they're adding Russian in this case. The problem lies when they come with no literacy skills at the higher levels. And then we have less time. For example, at the high school, we have a huge pressure to try to accommodate the needs of the students who do not have literacy skills and trying to get them to read, get them to write in their language, in this case, in Spanish or in English, and get them into the credits that they need. That's a monumental task that we confront. And that's the different ways that our teachers are working in terms of levels at the high school.
Thank you.
Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Batista, thank you for your presentation. I can have some empathy with this young students you're working with. At 47 years old, I tried to learn Serbo-Croatian, and it's not an easy task. Although we're supposed to be talking about assessment today, because of your expertise, I'm still having a tough time. Like in your testimony, you talked about Eugene has a Japanese immersion program. And if you could comment with your, based upon your expertise, why do you so strong support the bilingual program versus an immersion program other programs that are out there? To me, it looks like that would be best for younger kids and maybe older kids. You have to go to bilingual.
Exactly. One of the things in terms of research, the question for English language learners, they come in different circumstances. If we're talking about that's why I said I'm not here to establish that one model should be there, because to begin, we may not have the resources. And around the state, if you ask several districts that have at least one school, they're going to tell you, we don't have the teachers. And every single year, we are looking at which teachers are going to leave because we don't have the capacity right there. That's one. Only when you have the resources in order to do that, and the understanding, the knowledge base to do the program, then it's advisable. Otherwise, it's very difficult. In terms of practicality, the law established very clearly that you cannot serve a child, English language learner, the same as you serve in an English only. You have to make accommodations. That's why I say the majority of our students are in accommodation. English language techniques, shelter instruction. Those kinds of techniques help the student to continue developing his English. In that case, you need to work very strongly with the family in terms of continue the oral development at home. So you have two fronts working together. Sometimes many of our parents are socioeconomic disadvantaged, and both of them are working, so you have a child that is not developing anything at home. So the problem constitutes in how the school is going to understand what is the population and how you're going to deal with poverty issues. And the research has been very clear in your Appendix 6 in looking at how students fare out in 11 years. That's the study that has been done to us like an audit. of your programs. In that audit, you can see very clearly, for example, Nelly Muir, students from kindergarten to fifth grade with no bilingual program are meeting benchmark, which is great. That's what we want. They don't require bilingual program. However, the students that are in the bilingual program are meeting benchmark. So I can tell you now that these students have a step forward in terms of they are advancing. And if we continue in terms of middle school and high school, we have international baccalaureate that supports other languages. So it supports Russian, it supports English, obviously, and it supports Spanish. So the advantage that opens for these students, look at the university system, is rewarding students that come with language skills.
Representative Wisnett, I think to put that in, well, not to say that David's way above me with his terminology, but to put it in more everyday language, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when students are in middle school and high school, each year the content area increases, our requirements for math standards and such. So if you didn't have a bilingual teacher teaching calculus, and so that there's the commitment that students aren't only just learning English, so they are working in our American system, but also that they have the content. I can't even imagine, as you said, you know, learning calculus as a language learner in Croatia, you know, if you don't know the language. And so as they move through the system and the content gets more rigorous and more rigorous, so that if you want our students to, you know, achieve at this level of knowledge, if they come as their 13-year-old, and whether they're from Ukraine or whatever, if they can't have some assistance and understanding in their native language of some of those concepts, I mean, they're getting left behind. And it's that's what makes it up to the districts and the communities to say, how can we best help all of our children succeed? So, Representative Dahlem.
I hear the discussion of reaching benchmark by fifth grade. Mm-hmm. If we reach benchmark by fifth grade, what proficiency in English language do we have? Are there degrees of proficiency? It would seem that once you have mastery, you have mastery. Out on the playground, your vocabulary grows as your friends grow. You may come home with non-English speaking parents, but so the question to me is, if we've reached mastery, do we freeze at that level, or is there an atrophy of language development, or why aren't we staying proficient once proficiency is reached?
One of the things that, exactly, very good question. One of the things that happen in terms of language development is that tasks begin to get difficult. And if the students didn't have that strong foundation, they're not going to be able to achieve. And that's where I'm pointing to the research that you have in your appendix. Very clearly, all students are going to show that they're developing English, academic English, in elementary grades. But at the time when they get into the middle school and high school, mm-hmm. that proficiency is not that they're frozen, but they didn't have the strong element, the cognitive elements to continue growing.
Yeah.
So that's what happened with many of our students. While, as opposed with the bilingual program, the students have developed the cognitive development, and they're developing that both. So you have a stronger way in ways to understand that academic task that you can put in front of them.
It is interesting research that's being developed. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Batista, thank you for being here. Thank you for your excellent testimony. I very much appreciate your approach of not defining any particular model, but looking for models that work, that are based on research and that can be assessed. And I was able to visit Phoenix Elementary School, and I can't tell the committee how energized that campus is with the two-way immersion program. It's a fantastic approach. It's gained some very good results. Just a very quick question on something that you covered. You mentioned a bill by Representative Miller. Can you give me that information again?
It's in
appendix?
Yes. Miller, H.R. 2835-109, Congress.
2835? 2835. Thank you very much. And members of the committee, just to note, the Subcommittee on Higher Ed will be having a hearing next week to try to bring out how our higher ed system is training teachers to teach in the different programs for the second language.
Just one last question before we let you off the stand there, David. You have a number, we have 9 appendixes. If you could recommend one of those things that we should read before we go home, what would you think would help all of us the most?
The one that I mentioned is bipartisan. It's a group, a strong group at the national level. It's the report is Education for Global Leadership by the Statement Research and Policy Committee of the Committee for Economic Development. Okay. And I just put the conclusion. I put what is the report and also the website if you want the full report. But in there, the recommendation and conclusions are just excellent to read. And if I may, just to read this piece, the conclusion of this report states, and I quote, "The forces of globalization will continue to present challenges to our economic security, national security, and multicultural security. As national economics grow ever more interconnected, American corporations doing business at home and abroad will increasingly depend on employees who have a broad and sophisticated understanding of the world, its languages, culture, and politics. We need a very well-prepared citizen for the next 20, 50 years. And we are at that crossroad, I believe."
Thank you. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Mr. Mark.
Moving forward with our agenda, I believe we have Frederick, is it Mickle or Michael?
Mickle.
Mickle and Ernest Valdez talk to us about the ACT, the Explore Plan, and ACT assessment.
Give us some time allotment so we can respect the others or not. Would that be helpful?
3 minutes, 4 minutes, we're here.
If you could do your presentation in 10 to 15 minutes, then give us time for questions so that we finish here by 2 with your presentation.
Excellent.
Okay. I thought you were asking how much time do you have to set up?
Well, excellent. I'll get started. Full advantage of our time. Madam Chair, committee members, and those attending this meeting here this afternoon, my name is Ernest Valdez. I'm the Assistant Vice President and Regional Manager for ACT out of our West Region office, Sacramento, California, and Denver, Colorado. To my right here is a gentleman, Frederick Mickle, who's our Director for Post-Secondary Services, West Region office. And we service the state of Oregon as well as 15 others for the West Region. To give you some context is that I presented to you the West Region. Our national office is out of Iowa City, Iowa. We were founded in 1959 by Dr. E.F. Lindquist, who was a premier psychometric expert that actually was on the Board of Trustees for ETS. So it's a wild kind of story in history. But here we sit today in 2007, and thank you for the opportunity to present briefly ACT's assessment model and application here in this state over the last couple of years, frankly. With that said, I'm hoping that we're ready to go with the PowerPoint to give you the visuals that will get us moving forward. I'm going to click through very quickly, and then we'll open it up for questions and certainly challenge us. You do have a copy of our PowerPoint presentation in front of you, I hope, as well as a folder, and I'm sure and confident that you will read that Saturday evening for about 3 hours to get all the details that I may have missed. With that said, open the folder, and there are four key pieces. I'll refer to them a time or two during the presentation. One would be is what we call our case studies. It's a relatively thick document. It actually covers case studies in the state of Illinois, in the state of Colorado over the last 6 years that we've had statewide administration of the ACT and what EPASS program, and I'll explain what EPASS means in terms of a system and how we go about developing our programs, how they're used in the states. This is evidence-based, statewide scaled out, and has proof in test of concept and what began 6 years ago and where we are today with those states. And so I wanted to highlight that point. Another document is using the ACT as a cornerstone in Oregon State Testing Program, setting the record straight. There are bullet points there because we recognize, especially in this format, people want it concise and to the point and pretty much benefit statements. How does this work? And the evidence. We tried to do that and customize it for the state and for this presentation. A third document is summary for state testing models, and it actually illustrates the testing models that set up in other states, Illinois, Colorado, Michigan, Tennessee, and Wyoming, and we have a few others that have joined recently in terms of statewide adoption. Those are the mechanics, some of the details of how they're set up in the states, and wanted to make sure that you have the opportunity to look at that detail. The last document, our ACT scores sent to Oregon universities and colleges. This is a result of last year's test administration. It's got the actual students that took the ACT and where they sent their test scores to within this state. And the reason I decided to include that is because we're not as well known as the so-called other folks. And yet there's a significant number of ACT scores that are sent to the universities. In terms of policy, and the currency of that policy in terms of admission testing, they're both equally accepted with the universities here in this state, and so I wanted to highlight that point. So I think I'm ready to get going here, and it ran beautifully here in terms of the PowerPoint.
And we do have the document here right in front of us,
and
so we can...
We'll get clicking along here, and then maybe when it pops up on the screen, I'll refer to points on the screen. If you can go to page one, and of course, the first slide we can definitely avoid, and move over to the right, slide two. And as you very well know, there's no mystery in terms of a national agenda that the economic imperative and social imperative of the future is that students need to be college and workplace ready. And it's written in all documents. We know it. The question really is, how do we address those concerns on national scale, state scale, and what we will share with you, our experience has been over the last 6 years. You go to the slide below, the third slide on the left-hand side, second row, and although students aspire to achieve in that way in terms of higher education, to continue their education, many of them are not as well as prepared as they need to be. I think it's very evident on the back end with many post-secondary systems and institutions and the notion of remediation and the duality of admitting students in terms of access and the notion, are they well prepared to achieve in their freshman year and fundamentally graduate out and complete and get a baccalaureate degree, a certification, a one-year training program at a community college, et cetera, et cetera. I think the issue over the last 20 years continues to grow, And there are questions of how do we deal with that. We will offer some suggestions as we move forward. So as you look to the right there, what's being called for? Number one, a rigorous high school curriculum for all students. Last week we were here with formal presentation with the Oregon Board of Education, and the passage of requirements of courses for high school diploma is a definite move in the right direction and very consistent with what's going on across the nation. College readiness opportunities for all students, all inclusive. We're fraught with our history of when we went to school about who goes to college and who doesn't, and that notion of selection. All students need to be college ready. We just need to define it in a very particular way. And when we say that, all post-secondary institutions. Career, college, and work readiness indicators included in state standards and measures. As you very well know, the SIM program exists here and up to the 10th grade. What does it measure in terms of construct, content, and does it meet its intended purpose currently or in the future in the direction of the assessment programs? The agenda, quite frankly, has changed. That college and workplace readiness seems to resonate across the nation and what states are trying to do to address that for all their students. Curriculum-based assessments with meaning and relevance for all stakeholders. What we mean by that is it's a common language, and I'll share with you how we go about that. It is also student-based, not system-based. The kind of information that students receive is very relevant to him or her. And I would challenge you, we would be glad to send you material, because when you read the reports, you actually see how that's illustrated. It's not driven from systems that are for other intended purposes. And lastly, that it be seamless and streamlined as an educational assessment system. We have studied the state. We know that is a desire for longitudinal data, for foundational proficiency, for in parallel, at some point, bridging college and workplace expectations. Where does that begin? We'll share with you what our thoughts are. Use of the ACT and state testing programs, the bottom left-hand corner on the right side. Oh, we're catching up here. That's excellent. I'm moving forward here. Thank you. Does the ACT measure state standards and expectations? We want to address that. Why states are considering the ACT, and what are the results, the evidence of that experience? Does the ACT measure state standards? Well, first of all, foundationally based on empirical content data that's gathered by ACT, we are the only assessment instrument, college admission instrument, that goes out and surveys every 3 years professors and what they expect freshman level year in English, math, reading, and science. We also survey secondary instructors and what they are teaching to prepare students, and it's a fascinating survey to determine the gap when we look at expectation, freshman level work, and what is being taught and emphasized in K-12 schools. The ACT measures and contains college readiness standards. We have our college readiness standards that are curriculum statements that clearly state what the student knows dependent on their score range performance on the ACT and, for that matter, on our assessment, other assessment programs. College readiness benchmarks. We have calibrated cut scores based off research with students at colleges and universities on getting a B or better, 50% probability, and we have those cut scores, so we know how to benchmark. It is based off real data, not concepts about what our test development people do. We have actually challenged states with their systems. An example would be the University of Oregon system. We would be willing to conduct that kind of research to help calibrate those cut scores in this state. We do it in other states. The last statement would be is that the ACT can be customized to meet state assessment needs also. And I'll share a few aspects of that, especially with the No Child Left Behind initiative and requirements that are related to meeting No Child Left Behind and recognizing the situation the state is in at this point. The next visual illustrates our statewide adoptions and partnerships across the nation. As I stated to you earlier, it is not only an emerging issue, it is an issue that many states are trying to address as it relates to college and workplace readiness. Why states are choosing the ACT is because, number one, it's aligned to state standards. We have conducted content alignment studies in 38 of the 50 states, Oregon we have, and it's illustrated in the document where the alignment is at. Overall, of course, you could assume that our standards, because they're related to college readiness and workplace skill standards, that when you overlap and cross-match with state standards, there are gaps. Because we address the college readiness standard. We do have that research available if you would like to take a look at it. In addition, there is a perceived quality with state assessments when you use the ACT. Simply put, students are motivated. They see the benefit of taking the ACT given that it's used for college admission. In many states where I've observed, there is this inclination to how do you motivate students to take a state-mandated test? Do they take it seriously? And we know that in terms of a college admission exam, they certainly do and put their best foot forward when they take the examination. Test score can be compared with students within the state and can be transportable given that it's a national college admission exam. So it has multiple benefits on that front. It has value to stakeholders in terms of all the reporting that we provide to the state, the district, schools, and to the individual student and parent. And lastly, it articulates higher education expectations to K-12 schools. As I stated to you, how we keep the ACT up to date with the national survey every 3 years, and then we clearly communicate those expectations at K-12. What are the results of using the ACT? One statement is, measure state standards is too hard for all students. That hasn't been our experience in Illinois or Colorado. Initially, when they administered the ACT statewide, the greatest fear, quite frankly, were with superintendents that their scores were going to go down. And, you know, quite frankly, that's self-preservation, as opposed to the belief that students can actually achieve when we facilitate environment for them in that way. The next statement is, in-school test administration is working. The reason we know is the first-year administration in Colorado had the highest attendance rate in the history of that state. And be assured, I was involved from day one in the state of Colorado with Governor Owens' Education Reform Initiative, the then Governor Owens, and all the naysayers said what a bleak day that would be should the state move forward in that way, and the reality proved totally different. High school student motivation and participation is there, and as I stated, inherent in the ACT because of what it means. And colleges, scholarship agencies, and the NCAA accept the results in their use. What are the benefits? Increased participation addresses the aspirations that marry up with plans, especially educational plans, sound educational planning that is imperative to match up with aspiration. Achievement, because we are curriculum-based achievement measurement, and it is our solid foundation and philosophy of how we approach all our assessment instruments, we marry up that achievement with the achievement measures that we use in English, math, reading, and science. The emphasis and the alignment of college prep coursework selection that we know is very important, and the assumption the rigor is there in that transcript with those course titles. Enrollment in college with minority and low-income students, we have come, and the evidence shows there in Colorado and Illinois, the largest group that benefited with statewide adoption for the ACT in those two states were Latino and African American students in terms of participation and matriculation into post-secondary education. It's proven, it's provided there in the document. And also, the added benefit that college readiness and preparation increases retention in college. I'm going to move over to defining what we call EPAS, the Education Planning and Assessment System. We take a system approach. We also know that there is so-called curb appeal with the culminating event taking the ACT, but that is a singular event at a point in time, typically in their junior year. We take a system approach because we know it is developmental, process-driven, and students need to visit where they're at particular points in time of their education experience. What do we mean by system? You see the definition there that, quite frankly, we took it out of the Webster's Dictionary the other day to reiterate the interacting, interrelated, or interdependent elements forming a complex whole, EPAS. Well, the pieces are for us is explore 8th and 9th grades that are normed for those students and their normed criterion reference assessment programs, given the fact that we have college readiness statements along with the norms for results. Plan is at the 10th grade and the ACT at the 11th and 12th grades, which compose EPAS, our Education Planning Assessment System. What are the common components of EPAS? You see there, I'm just going to click down them, is the test of academic achievement. We measure the same four areas with Explore, Plan, and the ACT. They're just simply calibrated and normed at those particular grades. They're equated and scaled. So by way of example would be is the Explore scale goes from 1 to 25, the Plan scale goes from 132, and the ACT goes from 1 to 36. We can match, we can do link reports to determine individual progress at particular points in time of their education experience. The benchmarks, college readiness benchmarks, we have benchmarking also at the 8th grade. Where are they at in terms of college readiness at the 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, as well as 11th and 12th with the ACT? It is not too late at that point in time to emphasize additional coursework, achievement, and measurement as a validation of what kind of progress that student is making. The added benefit, and this is from my perspective, is the non-cognitive side, where we marry up that picture of academic course planning, achievement measurement and validation, and career interest and exploration. And those are three key components that are the hallmark of ACT and how we develop our programs. Career development has pretty much taken a backseat to many other things, but it is just so important to connect that with the course plans and their achievement measures and their performance. The results, the bullet statements are there that indicate there's increased educational achievement and college readiness, that students take the right kinds of courses during their school years, that more effective educational career planning occurs, and the emphasis through what we call STEM reports and national reports on how we're behind in math and science and the imperative that we must make progress on the national scale and how we can do that here in the state. In addition to that is more college-ready students from underrepresented groups that I stated with you in the case study that would encourage you to review the particulars of that, and greater college enrollment success and retention at the culminating end, and quite frankly, students reaching their dream and accomplishing that particular certification and or degree. The challenge here in this state, as we see it, is that there are key ingredients. Does the state have the will to move forward? Does the state have a demand for it? Based on all the reports I see, I think you're at the crux of that situation right now, given that the state meets every 2 years, and the discussion and dilemma in terms of the new agenda here in the state of Oregon. The policy review as it relates to education and this notion of seamless transition to college, is it affordable? We'll provide you that information. You'll see that the programs really do and can be accomplished, and on a comparative basis, you'll compare what you currently have in place and determine that. And then support, our support, ACT, and our extensive experience that we have. As we move forward, and I know I only have a few minutes, is that the future vision of Oregon's assessment system, it is our opinion, must provide the inclusion of all students in a comprehensive system for college and workforce readiness and career planning. Number two, the integration of Oregon state standards as well as college and workforce readiness standards. Reengineered assessment, model, inclusive of foundational proficiency at particular grades 3 and 5 in discipline areas in science and reading, along with college and workplace readiness, and must provide the ability to meet state, No Child Left Behind, and college and workplace requirements. ACT stands by to provide Oregon our extensive statewide assessment experience over the last 6 years, our research expertise and test item development and capability, as well as Oregon School District testimony on the benefits of EPASS. As I move forward, I would ask you at some point in time to maybe invite some of these school districts that have come on board with EPASS in the last year and last 2 years. Beaverton with Superintendent Jerome Colonna, year one and year two. They're immersed in it right now. Come February, they actually administered EPASS to over 9,000 students in one day. An incredible experience. I witnessed and went to every school. I let him tell you what his surprise was. He calls it the aha experience. Portland School District is new this year with the Explore at Ninth Grade and the ACT with Writing for all juniors this coming 07 administration. Hillsboro with Jeremy Lyons and 8th grade Explore and 11th grade this coming year. Tigard Tualatin with Superintendent Rob Saxton, 11th grade, the ACT with Writing as one singular program, and then Forest Grove School District, Jack Musser, year one, ninth grade Explore, and 10th grade Plan without the ACT. I wanted to illustrate these models because it represents a rainbow and varied models that I think you would want to find out what their experience has been. That concludes the presentation. I'll just provide summary up there and won't emphasize those points, but I think it would be transformational. I've been fortunate to witness in Colorado, Michigan, and Illinois what the original expectations were, and they weren't positive, and what the reality of the experience was in terms of moving forward on a college and workplace readiness agenda in the state for their assessment programs. Thank you for your time, and I'll open up to questions and hope that I haven't violated a time rule.
Well, considering Representative Dolan's just about to jump out of his chair, we will make sure that questions are responded to in a timely way.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I built a checklist, and I don't want to take the committee's time because I am jumping out of my chair. And if I have the check mark correct, if you'll nod yes, I'll skip over the question. There are several provisions I'd like to make sure that each test does.
Okay.
And will this test is the
so
beginning?
So you're giving the next group a heads up, so they better be taking notes.
Somebody's got to go first, and somebody's got to go last. I guess if you're second or third, you can add to the list. But you do provide diagnostics for the individual student. So
yes.
Okay. And you do. You are normed nationally. You can measure state standards. You do provide career development. Now, when you talk about specific disciplines, I'm particularly interested in how you assess science, because how each test approaches that, I think, will give us an accurate measurement of what we're doing. So how do you approach the science assessments?
We have a content domain that we measure. We actually will share with you how we do measure in that area, and we can provide that information for you. It's more general. It's not specific to biology and intense and dug down in that particular way. So it's science more in general, and the items that relate to physics, biology.
It's more integrated?
Integrated, yes, and a sampling of items from each.
And you do provide assessment of math. I heard that. Social studies?
Reading.
English, both grammar and lit, or grammar and reading?
Yes.
Mechanics.
And you provide college placement. I heard that loud and clear.
College admission and placement.
Can we use this test for No Child Left Behind placement? Or
yes.
To determine school progress?
Yes.
We can measure the child and the school?
Yes.
I heard you say that we can do program evaluation with this instrument.
That's correct.
I heard you say that we can do college probability of success as early as grade 8 with this instrument.
Yes, college benchmarking. College
and I heard you say that we can measure students' aptitude for success in college.
Aptitude? I don't know if I use that word.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then cost, you said you'd provide us information. Then I would say, can you cross-match your test results with our present state test results? For example, show where, can you do that?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Mickle, I need you to state your name for the record.
Frederick L. Mickle, Jr.
Thank you. Is that it, Representative Robles?
That's not it, but I have a place to start so that I can compare these three instruments, and I think it's imperative that we be able to do that.
Okay. Any other comments from the committee? Thank you for your presentation, and boy, you did it within 3 minutes of the, you know, plus or minus four. You're okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
And with that, we will have Chris Savali and Rebecca Hernandez come from the Scholastic Aptitude Test Foundation and share with us your information. That's a good idea.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I ask for cost information and a sample of science strategy. Could I ask that to be delivered to the administrator and all?
Yes, absolutely.
I've
got
my cold. Science is tested and sampled.
And if the presenters would just acknowledge yourself for the record before we start, then I won't forget it later on.
Absolutely. Perhaps while Rebecca is setting up here, I'll go ahead and introduce us. Madam Chair and Representatives, thank you so much for inviting us to be here today. My name is Chris Savoli. I am the Senior Director for Government Relations and Advocacy. Although I'm housed in San Jose, California, I actually have a national position working across the 12 western states. With me today is Rebecca Hernandez. Rebecca is a K-12 educational manager in the Western Regional Office in San Jose, and she travels the 12 western states talking to districts, schools, educators, and states.
And I will need to hear Rebecca's voice and say, and I'm Rebecca Hernandez. Oh.
Hello, Madam Chair, Representatives. I am Rebecca Hernandez, Educational Manager in the Western Regional Office of the College Board.
Thank you
for having
Perfect.
Me here today.
Perfect.
And let me just tell you quickly about our background, because I think it is germane to our passion for our work with the College Board. I'm a former Director of Admissions for a small college, and before that I was a middle school and a high school teacher. Rebecca is a former Director of Early Literacy for San Mateo County and a former worker at UC Berkeley in early academic outreach, visiting middle schools and trying to get more middle school students ready for college. Both of us are the first in our family to graduate from college, and that's really why we, I think, have migrated to this work. Our discussion will be, first, I'll give a quick overview. I've been at the College Board 21 years, so I always give the historic overview. Rebecca, again, will talk a little bit about our system and how our programs work together to improve rigor. And then, finally, I will comment on all the work we are currently doing at the state level. Are you ready, Madame?
Yeah. And, Chris, can I, either move the microphone a little more forward or...
Too loud?
Yes, you're just a little close.
I was one of seven children, so I do have... I do speak loudly. Okay. So you have, again, our titles and names. And slide two, please. So what is the College Board? I have found in traveling across the state of Oregon, and actually even when I fly, and I fly a lot, I'm 100K with United, and I'll be sitting next to someone on the plane, and they'll say, what do you do? And I'll say, you know, I work for the College Board. And they'll say, oh, which college? Or they'll say, is that in Princeton? Or they'll say sometimes, oh, it's the SAT. And then, of course, they always have a son or daughter who's taking the SAT, and that's the rest of the flight. But I'd like to go to the next slide, and I'm sure when you thought about the College Board today, what came to mind was not our mission statement. But I do want to emphasize it. We are a very old organization. We were founded in the year 1900 with 10 member institutions. And at that time, the mission was simply stated to improve transition from high school to college. Today, we're an organization of 5,200 members, colleges, high schools, districts, and states. And again, our mission is to connect students to college success and opportunity. And our real focus, really since our new president in the last 8 years, is on equity and excellence, and the belief that those two are essential for any college and one of the most important issues you can work on right now in this country. So next slide. Again, I do think probably we are most famous for the SAT. That's because about 3 million, more than 3 million students take the test every year. Any test that touches that many lives should be always under the microscope, and it certainly is. Media coverage, certainly. But it was the first SAT was actually given in 1926, and then it was put on our famous 200 to 800 scale in 1941. And then in 1959, we decided there should be a practice for the SAT. So the PSAT was created. And the PSAT is now at about 3 million students, and it's given in 90% of all the high schools. It's also given in about 130 different countries around the world. And the SAT has 6,400 test centers around the world, and it is administered in 165 countries. And then I should also mention, if you're not familiar with NMSQT, that is the National Merit Scholarship Qualifying Test. Until the year 1971, they had their own test. Now they've decided that our test is the rigorous test to use for identifying National Merit Scholars. So it's the only entry vehicle to National Merit. And then one of the programs I love the most is AP, or Advanced Placement. That's in its 51st year. We offer 37 tests in 22 different subjects and curriculum. It's probably the closest thing the country has to a national curriculum. In explaining what AP is, my sister works for IBM, and I gave her a little College Board acronym quiz, and when she got to AP, she said, must be accounts payable. And I said, no, it's actually advanced placement courses, and they're not really college prep courses. They are college courses taught in high school. And that's the clarification that we give. The scale is from 1 to 5. We recommend getting college credit for a score of 3 or better. Next slide. And then the percents on the right there are just the percent of schools that offer our assessments. All right. And then I thought you would be interested to see parallel information for the state of Oregon. I've given you the volume for each, the annual volume last year for those three assessments, and then to the far right are the number of high schools that administer. It translates to about 90% for SAT and PSAT, and about two-thirds for AP, which is very similar to our nation. All right. I always like, as a former admissions director, to put the SAT into some kind of context, because I think too often it's taken out of context. And as I said, there's so much misinformation about how it's used. So whenever I'm talking to educators, I make them stop and think for a minute about what do you think are the most important factors when you apply to college? And why don't you go on to the next slide? Now, I put this in because the New Yorker seems about every 10 years they like to exaggerate the importance of the SAT. In fact, I always have to tell the story about a friend of my husband's. When he found out he worked for the College Board, he quickly told me, you know, I was first in my class at Yale in engineering, and I only got a 780 on the math. And do you think you could figure out what question I missed? And I said, you know, Stan, you're 40 years old. I think it's time to let that go. But the reason I did want that slide up is because we will no longer have a verbal and a math score. Our verbal, which is very similar, our new critical reading score, which is very similar to the old verbal, the fully equated. But we now have a three-prong test, so it's critical reading, mathematics, and then there's the third prong of writing, which is two-thirds multiple choice and one-third essay. So every SAT that is administered now includes writing. PSAT added writing in 1997. So it's been on PSAT for quite some time. And then again, the next slide. And then again, this is the answer to the question, what are the most important factors? There's an annual survey done independently every year by the National Association for College Admission Counseling. It's sent to four-year colleges. It's important to see that of considerable importance would be grades and college prep, In second place, however, is standardized tests. And if you were to read the media, you would think that tests are becoming less and less important in the admission process. In fact, that percentage has grown tremendously in the last 10 years as far as importance in admissions. I think the reason for that has to do with the fact that with our own SAT takers, 10 years ago, 28% declared a 4.0 or a straight A average. Last year, 42% have a straight A average. So more and more, because grades do vary so broadly from school to school and teacher to teacher, admissions officers really do want that common task that is done nationally within a standardized setting. Okay, and now we're going to move to Rebecca Hernandez, and she's going to talk a little bit about our College Board system.
Thank you, Chris. This is a diagram that shows you a snapshot of the College Board's K-12 system for success. And as you can see, we have some programs that start in the middle school years. For example, Spring Board in sixth grade, College Ed in seventh, then My Road in eighth grade. And we also have some other programs that are primarily offered to students in high school.
They're very sensitive mics.
Is that 7 to 12?
Yes. The continuum, Spring Board and College Ed actually go all the way through, from 6th to 12th grade, College Ed 7th, all the way to 12th grade. So Spring Board is a program that provides teachers with instructional materials and training in English, language, arts, and mathematics to provide students with more rigor in the classroom. College Ed provides students from 7th to 12th grade with lessons and workbooks so they can begin planning and preparing for their post-secondary options, whether that be entering the workforce or going straight into college. But we just want to make sure that all students have the option. My Road is also available to middle school students, and it is a website that allows students to research colleges, majors, and careers. The Advanced Placement Program, as Chris already mentioned, are college-level courses offered in the high school. The PSAT is the preliminary SAT, so it's practice for the SAT, and the SAT is our college entrance examination. So to just quickly summarize this slide, all of these programs and assessments provide students with the academic rigor, information, and motivation that they need to be successful in college and in the workplace. Many districts and schools start with the PSAT as their launching pad onto this college and career path because it's oftentimes the best investment. The returns that they get on this investment are quite substantial because we offer benefits for the student and for the teacher and the school as well. For example, the PSAT gives students personalized information about their academic strengths and weaknesses with a student score report. It also gives students free access to MyRoad for the rest of their academic career. So if they take the PSAT in 10th grade, they can actually use MyRoad until they graduate from high school. Benefits provided to teachers include the Summary of Answers and Skills report, which provides teachers with an item-by-item analysis of how their students perform in critical reading, math, and writing on the aggregate so that they can begin to identify trends and can begin to connect assessment to curriculum and instruction. And teachers are also able to use a free software tool that we have called AP Potential. And what AP Potential allows teachers to do is to use the PSAT data that is generated to identify and recruit students into AP courses. So these are additional benefits for students that take the PSAT. As I mentioned, it's the best practice for the SAT. On average, students that take the PSAT score about 100 points higher when they take the SAT. It fosters skill improvement because we give them very personal feedback on how they fared in the three different sections. It is also the only exam that is affiliated with the National Merit Scholarship Competition. It also provides, again, information about colleges, majors, and careers through the MyRoad tool. And it's also connected to our student search service, which provides colleges the opportunity to send information to students about their university. So it's a great way for universities to recruit students to come to their campus. And it's also a great encouragement for students to take the AP because of the AP Potential tool. So in your folders, you actually have a sample in your of this student score report. So this is the paper report that is distributed to all students that take the PSAT. You can just take that out. You will see that at the very top, the first section, we provide students with their scores in the three sections, critical reading, math, and writing. We also give them national percentiles, and we give them score ranges. So if they were to take the exam again, they, without any additional studying, they would score somewhere within that range. In the second section, which is the bulk of the report, we actually provide them with their item-by-item analysis, so basically looking at how they fared on every single question on the PSAT. The next section at the very bottom is the Improve Your Skills section, and in that section, we give students recommendations on how they can improve on the skills, not where they were most deficient, but the areas where, with just a little extra effort, they'll see significant gains. And in your packets, we also included a document that aligns the skills that we test for on the PSAT to your Oregon State standards. So it's a black and white document. It's PSAT alignment. I believe it's on the right side. And the fourth section of the report gives students information about the National Merit Scholarship. It provides the selection index. And the fifth section just gives them some more information about the major and career that they are interested in pursuing. Students can also go to our website, and there they can access a free personalized SAT study plan based on their PSAT performance. They can also access an online version of the paper score report that I gave you, where they can actually receive answer explanations. So their students can actually go and read why the correct answer was the best option and why all of the other options were not. So it helps students connect assessment to learning. Students can also access My College Matches and My Career and Major Matches, and that's where we give them additional information based on what they told us they were interested in. The next program that is available and is affiliated with the PSAT is MyRoad, and that is also on our website. And MyRoad provides students with information on 67 majors, 175 instructional programs, 63 careers, 455 occupations, and it also allows students to compare colleges and universities based on a number of criteria. In addition, we also have a Myers-Briggs type tool on MyRoad so that students can have a personality assessment, and then we give them recommendations as to what careers or majors they might be interested in pursuing. The next benefit of the PSAT is AP Potential. And again, AP Potential is a tool that we devised to help teachers identify more students who are not self-selecting for rigorous courses. So with AP Potential, we can give teachers a more objective tool to identify students to take AP courses. And we're able to do this because we've correlated PSAT score results to AP exam results. So we all agree that taking an AP course is a very valuable experience for students because it prepares them for college. But how do we actually build that pipeline? How do we ensure that when students get to high school, they're prepared to take AP courses? One of the best ways to do that is to offer pre-AP workshops to teachers. This is where we go and we deliver quality training for teachers in certain subject areas, and we provide them with teaching strategies to engage students in active high-level learning. Focuses on reading, on readying students with the skills, study habits, and learning strategies to succeed in rigorous courses like AP. Another pre-AP initiative that we offer is called Springboard. And what Springboard does is it provides professional development, but it also includes instructional materials and diagnostic assessments that give students, that give teachers and students immediate feedback on how they are faring on college readiness standards. And Hermiston School District in Eastern Oregon is in its second year of implementing Springboard for English Language Arts. And as a matter of fact, on Monday, they're going to be hosting an open house for other districts in Oregon that are interested in seeing Springboard in action. And there are a couple of districts that are already going to go and visit. So we welcome any of you who might be interested in attending that open house. Another program that we have to offer is College Ed. And College Ed provides students and teachers with lessons and materials that contain information on making the correct academic choices in high school, as well as ones for college and career search. And it gives detailed information on financial aid and other valuable information for both parents and students. We also include a family handbook because we think it's important to engage the parent or the family, and we encourage them to begin the dialogue very early on in middle school. So these are just some of the other benefits. And currently, Oregon Gear Up uses College Ed with all of its schools. How many of you are familiar with Gear Up? Okay. Well, it's a federal...
Can I say that's a whole other program?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, and if you could finish up in 2 minutes to, so that Representative Dahlin can ask his test, because we have a test to take too. So.
Okay.
Because, yeah, GEARP is a comprehensive
program. Oh, absolutely.
Program.
Absolutely. So it's a federal program, and they also use it there too. So, Chris?
Okay, I think we've spoken enough about the SAT and its use. I did want to respond to one of the questions that was asked of ACT about the predictive validity of the test. We do offer a free validity study service to all the colleges in the country, so they're able to see how well the SAT predicts. Martha Pitts, who's your director of admissions at University of Oregon, spoke to that last week and talked about that they have learned that actually the writing section of the SAT is the single best predictor. They use it also for placement, admission and for placement. And then they also use the math section of the SAT for placement, and that has saved them a lot of money. All right, so let's just quickly look. These are the states that are currently paying for our programs. The state of Maine is using the SAT both as their exit exam and for No Child Left Behind, recently approved for No Child Left Behind. There are 12 states and two districts large enough to be states that are paying statewide for the PSAT, with Florida probably being our greatest success story. Oregon is famous for having received two of the 20 federal advanced placement grants that were given in the last 3 years, and I think that explains the exploding growth of AP in your state. You've been increased by about 75% as far as your AP participation, and that was because your Department of Ed wrote and got not one but two of the 20 grants that were given. Again, College Ed is paid for, and Rebecca mentioned Springboard. I just want to quickly show you probably the greatest example of our working with the state and the kind of performance and the participation and the results. So if you would take out on the left-hand side, you will find, and this, by the way, this brochure was not done by us. It was done by the Department of Ed in the state of Florida. This program began, it's called the Florida Partnership. It began about 8 years ago, and at that time both the governor and the Department of Ed in Florida had three goals: to improve the academic rigor, to close the achievement gap for Latino and African American students, and to reduce remediation. So how did they go about doing that? Open to page 3 and look straight to the bottom, and you will see the history of participation for SAT test takers at the bottom of page 3 in the brochure. So you'll see that they have exploded with about, 73% growth for SAT and 148% growth for Hispanic students. If you turn to page 7 and 8, again, Rebecca talked about PSAT being the launching pad for our system. They did use the College Board system. They paid for all sophomores to take the PSAT, and you'll see it gives you the statistics on African-American students and Hispanic students. Again, with rampant growth, after the students took the PSAT, they used our software, AP Potential, to identify students who were likely to be successful at AP, and that's how they then were able, as you look at pages 8, 9, and 10, to grow participation in AP. The other byproduct of this was an enormous reduction in remediation for higher education. And when, every year, when this comes up, funding comes up for renewal, it's always a unanimous vote in both the House and the Senate, which I know doesn't happen every day. So that is, I think, probably our best example. And at this point, let us take questions.
Okay. And just one comment. I believe it's the state of Florida. I learned this several years ago and wanted to learn more about it. They have an incredible incentive program for their graduates to attend their own public universities. And it is something that we might look at as helping us. It's just an incredible program. And to hear that the state's not paying as much for remediation, now I can understand how they can afford the incentive program.
Yes, and of course the students bring college credit with them because of the AP that's been taken.
Right. Representative Dahlem, you're up.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm going to go down the same list.
And yes,
I think I did hear your answers, but I just want to be sure. You do provide diagnostics?
Yes, and you saw the PSAT score report both to the student and to the school. So they actually get question by question the percent in that school who got the answer right, and they have the test book in hand to understand that.
And you are normed nationally so that we would know how Oregon students sit against the nation?
Both, yes.
You could measure your test results against our state standard and do some number gymnastics and show us a comfort.
And that's actually in your packet. Rebecca mentioned it. It's on the right-hand side. It tells you skill by skill.
I'm getting
skill.
Evil eyes, so I'll go the yes.
Yes. and if you're really interested in standards, I'll leave this for you.
Thank you. I would. Okay. I think I've looked at most of your material, but if you leave anything, I would ask, Madam Chair, that you leave something
Absolutely.
For all of us. You provide career development in that you can identify proficiency or preponderance for career.
Yes, and let me just add to what Rebecca said. For the $12 price of the PSA, access to MyRoad, the software, is included for the duration of the student's high school career. If the student's in college ed and middle school, they have access to that software program for the rest of their career.
Then the area of science.
Yes, our science is similar to ACT's in that it's a reading passage. It is not an achievement test in science, and there's independent research that's done on that. If you want a true science achievement, you would have to use our subject tests, which would be physics, biology, and chemistry. And we have a whole other battery. I didn't talk about the SAT 2 subject tests that are end of course.
And then, so you do have a math assessment, a social studies assessment, writing and grammar.
That's correct.
And you provide college placement. I did not ask this of the other people, but in Oregon, it seems to me, we had a preponderance of students at one time taking the ACT 5-6 years ago, and the lesser number taking the SAT. Is that still true?
No, that's actually never been true. SAT has always been the dominant test. The ACT has recently gained, and the numbers Ernest and Fred shared with you are their recent growth, and I'm sure they would confirm that.
Can we use this?
You're thinking probably of Montana.
Whoa.
I'm not going there.
I did mark that No Child Left Behind. Florida uses this for an exit exam, so I'm sure that I could put a check there.
No, actually, Florida is not using it for No Child Left Behind. They have their own state assessment. The state of Maine is using it for No Child Left Behind, and perhaps Pennsylvania will.
And can we use this instrument for program evaluation?
Yes, and that's what Rebecca talked about. That's probably one of the real strengths of the board. We have enormous professional development for AP teachers using our item analysis for PSAT, working back with the teacher. So it's not just about the student. It's about both students and teachers, both for PSAT and advanced placement and Springboard.
And you can predict with the PSAT probability of college success?
you can predict linkage to SAT, which of course is extremely well aligned, but all the research that's been done is really on the SAT at the end of freshman year in college or through our free validity study service. But yes, you can predict an SAT, but the research is done on SAT. Down the same scale, you just add a zero.
And I did not ask, but do you have an electronic version available, or is it?
We have a computer-adapted version of the SAT for the talent search kids, the kids in 7th and 8th grade, but it was very costly. So we have really, because we really care about equity and access, we still find that rural schools and many schools with the most needy kids do not have the computer hardware to deliver. So we've actually kept it paper and pencil to keep the cost low. And we also offer fee waivers for SAT, 2 per student, and we offer a fee waiver for PSAT in the junior year. So if even a $12 is a hardship, that's a real commitment that we have.
Could you give us a price sheet so that we might compare?
Yes, in fact, I have. It's called At Your Fingertips. It's a little cardboard sheet that we that our counselors use.
And that completes the Dahlem graph.
Thank you, Professor Dahlem. Thank you for your presentation. I think we've learned a lot today and have a lot to think about as far as future of assessment in Oregon and what we might want to do. So thank you.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Doug Costi, would you join us and give us a test? Oh,
we have to show the results.
No, we do not ever show results. That's confidential information.
Share it with all your constituents.
Yeah. Right.
Probably. I'd like to request reading, not math. Writing's no problem. It's the math that was my little score on the SAT.
You'll see that I conveniently forgot to bring my computer today.
The Rhodes Scholar.
I'll look on with Representative Buckley. I'll help him.
Cheating is going.
We don't have a whole lot of time, Doug, but I know most of us got set up on the website.
Perfect. Chair Comp, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Doug Costi. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services for the Department of Education. With me today is Tony Alpert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Alpert, and I'm the Director of Assessment for the Department of Education.
Good.
Tony is the heavy lifter in the department in terms of measurements, so he's the guy that manages all of these programs. What we provided to you is a one-page overview of our Oregon assessment. We tried to get everything on one page so you get a sense of everything. And I know from what I understand, your charge is you want to take an assessment, a TESA assessment.
We want to see what it's like for students.
So Tony is firing up his computer and will kind of guide you down the road. And I'll give you a brief overview while he does that in grades. You'll be able to check the different grade levels and content areas. So as a way of background, over 90% of our tests, grades 3 through 8 and 10, are done online. We are leading the nation with respect to this, and we feel very proud of that. There's a lot of advantages to this, and there's some challenges and hurdles that we have to overcome. And with that, I'm going to let Tony explain those, take a couple minutes, and then we're going to launch into the assessment. And by the way, your results will be in front of you, so you don't have to worry about it.
Do you know which grade level I'm picking here?
I would go for probably about the 8th grade math and see what...
Do you know that I'm on 8th grade, or do you...
No.
No, I know. I can't see...
I'll be going where I want to, thank you.
...sample test, but it looks and feels like a real assessment. And I think what I would like to do for you is kind of give an explanation of a typical assessment, which is paper-based. A child will get a booklet, and then he'll get a separate answer sheet, a bubble sheet, and will start to bubble in, so they're moving from one document to another.
Right.
And here you can kind of see the obvious difference. So Tony will lead you through that and then show you some of the tools available.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I just wanted to briefly outline some of the advantages and challenges of TESA as we see it, and then walk through the assessment. TESA is a pretty remarkable new venture for Oregon. It's helped a lot of students with their instruction and teachers in evaluating their programs. The TESSA adapts to each student's ability, which allows a much shorter test with the same degree of certainty, or otherwise known as reliability. It provides more precise estimates of performance with your questions. It's cost-effective because we don't have to print and ship answer booklets or paper booklets or answer sheets. It allows multiple testing opportunities for students without a large increase in cost. It allows longer test windows because we don't have the logistics around shipping and printing. And the unique test for each student and large item pools tends to reduce the probability of cheating, which is also important.
Of course.
With TESSA, there's also challenges. It requires classroom computers and network bandwidth. The Oregon is breaking new ground, and that's challenging, especially when we're trying to get approval from the federal government. There are access concerns for students with disability as we're trying to get to the last mile of inclusion. The long test windows require staff from schools and ODE to be on demand for 9 months to be able to support schools in their testing. And the adaptive test and multiple testing opportunities requires large item pools, which is, there's a total cost of ownership for that. So with that, I want to briefly walk through some of our sample tests.
Here it comes.
And per the chair's request, what we'll talk about is we'll walk through a couple of questions for reading. And these are tests that we present for students who want to get accustomed to the process and become familiar with the test so that we're removing that uncertainty from the testing experience and focusing more on the content and their mastery of the content. On the left-hand side, you'll see a reading passage in this case, and the student is asked to read the passage, and then on the right-hand side, the student is asked to answer questions. The question of the stem appears at the top, and then the responses, otherwise known as distractors, appear in the lower right-hand corner. The student checks the box and asks if confirmation as to whether or not the student is ready to submit, and then the next question shows up. With reading, it's a relatively unique type of question. It's a single passage attached to which multiple questions are attached. And the reason why we do that is there's some degree of effort, some investment a student makes into reading a passage. So what we wouldn't want to do is we wouldn't want the student to go through a whole lot of effort to read a passage and then only ask one question about it. So we're trying to be efficient in the assessment process. So again, the student can ask another question, answer another question, and move on from there. I won't go through the whole process.
Which grade level did you choose?
I believe I choose fourth grade.
Okay, thank you.
And at the end of the test, after the student finishes, a score will pop up, and that score is then communicated between the teacher and the parent and the student, and there's a performance level attached to it. And as Representative Buckley heard today, there's a lot of work and investment that goes around deciding what that achievement level is, and that's goes into the student's learning profile. And then if they meet, they don't have to take the assessment again, but they certainly have the opportunity, either if they meet or do not meet, if they want to achieve a higher score.
For our demonstration purposes, if we don't want to do the reading, can we go back, use the back button, and go to a different assessment?
No, I believe you have to stop.
So we have to do
the
stop sign.
And then it should bounce you back to the beginning.
Okay.
You may want to look at the math. If you look at a math exam and the items, you can see a calculator in the bottom left-hand corner, which it's a tool that kids can pop up and take advantage of and use as part of the assessment.
Because there are different components for each
right.
type. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, if a student is going to take to retake the test, is it the exact same test, or is it, you know, if I'm taking the seventh grade reading test right now, so if I fail in this and then I want to try it again, do I get the same passages or do I get different passages?
It's an excellent question. What we do currently is we separate the test into three different item pools to ensure that a student isn't presented with the same questions. What we're investigating for the next iteration of TESA is having one large item pool and then having the computer track which questions a student has already been presented with so that we have access to the full item range and we still ensure that students don't get the same question again.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlem.
How many items in the pool are behind this single question? How many selections do I have?
For this content.
I'm sorry, could you answer the question?
This particular query, how many different ways, different items are in the pool for this one question?
This particular question is aligned to a content standard, mm-hmm. and there, depending on the test specifications, and I don't have that with me directly, but we allocate a certain amount of real estate to score reporting categories, and within score reporting categories, we have content standards. And so this would probably be under calculation and estimation, I'm guessing, in which case, at fourth grade, I think that's about 30 to 40% of the item pool. I'm not sure, but within that, within each opportunity, we have about between 200 and 300 items for a total of 600 items for each grade level and content area. And we want to build that up further to ensure a broader coverage of both depth and range for every student.
Thank you.
I'm on the statistics and probability questions, so I'm stumped. So.
My recommendation is stay away from the 10th grade test if you can, especially the math. It's, it's a bit challenging.
Well, you might just look at one just to get a grip. Yes.
Betty, if you would permit me time to ask my questions of Doug.
I don't know how much more you want to show us. I just literally wanted to have people get a feel of what it's like.
What we intended is what you've seen so far. So right. We just wanted to give you a flavor for what it's like on a web-based assessment versus what you might think or you remember from a paper-based assessment. There's quite a bit of difference.
If I might also add, you heard Mr. Batista talking today about the ELPA. That is another online assessment. It's, I believe, the only online assessment of English language proficiency. And through the computer, we collect samples of students' reading, writing, speaking, and listening ability, and that's all scored centrally. And that's a new test that mm-hmm. we're working on, but we believe that it will help with many of the struggles to receive longitudinal and good information for English language learners.
Is that a national test?
It is not. It's a test developed in concert with Language Learning Solutions, aligned specifically to Oregon's English language proficiency standards, which are aligned to Oregon's English language arts standards.
Right. And so then other states aren't using that assessment at this time?
Correct.
Okay. So you've worked that out together as a department to develop that assessment?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you take a minute? I don't know if we do the full Dahlem list because I don't know if it...
Yeah, takes him about 2 minutes.
If to see where you compare to ACT and SAT in terms of what services that this, that TESA provides in terms of some of the questions that Representative Dahlem had in terms of being able to predict student performance down the line, et cetera.
Well, can I do one other thing? Before you turn off your machines, you might add this to your favorites. So if you want to go home and give the quiz to your spouse or extended family so that you can know where it's at on the technology, but please go ahead and respond.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, The state is committed, and Doug and I especially are committed, to providing the service Oregon schools need based on the policymakers' decisions. And at this point, we've tried to create the most efficient, least costly, in many respects, test that meets the minimum requirements of the state and federal legislation. So at this point, we offer the short TESSA tests, which are 35 questions long, in contrast to many of the other assessments, which can range to about 100 to 120 questions. And so there are limits to what we would want people to use that data for. And we're very conservative in how we describe the decisions that should be made on the test. So with that context, I'm more than happy to answer the questions, and I want to provide good information about what the capabilities of the system are, but I want to make sure that it's clear how we got to the point that we're at.
And I would add to that, Chair Comp, if I may, the devil is in the details. So as you think about, you know, going down one path or another, we would really advise that you take a look at the feasibility of doing it, ask some other states what it took, specifically around adhering to the requirements of the federal government, NCLB. It is not a simple fit to take an off-the-shelf norm reference test and have it comply with the requirements of No Child Left Behind. And we do have examples from other states in terms of what it takes to get there.
Good. Okay, Representative Dahl, and you're going to get the last words.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Does the state assessment provide diagnostics?
It's hard for me to give a yes-no question. It depends on the definition of diagnostic. We give systems-level analysis. We support systems-level analysis. And with the long test, we give strand data reports for students. And so in that respect, it informs instruction. And but I'm not sure exactly.
Without, I'm going to go through my list, and I'll come back to that. Maybe give you a clarification. Is it nationally normed? Can we compare Oregon to other states?
No, not currently. It is possible we could purchase national norms and do a study to identify those if that was the direction of the legislature.
Okay. And it does measure state standards?
Yes.
In fact, it's built to state standards.
It is. Oregon teachers write the items specifically to the state content standards.
A guidance counselor or someone examining the test, can they identify some career development direction?
No, that is not currently part of the state standards.
Does it measure specific disciplines, science?
Mm-hmm. It does.
It's math? And how do you measure the science?
It's biology, physical sciences, and
discipline specific.
It's
predicated on our state.
Yeah, it's as specific as our state content standards are in that regard.
So I would put math, because we do test to what the state demands, I'm going to put yes.
Okay.
Do you care?
Social
studies?
Yes.
And I'm secondary, so I say English, but it does grammar and lit, or grammar and reading? Yes.
It does, yes. And we also have the on-demand writing performance assessment, which has six traits.
Do we still do the writing, a sample for each student, and bring in the teachers and grade that at a single sitting?
Yes, at grades 4, 7, and the SIM level, all students must take the assessment.
Provide college placement?
No. Although we do work with the Oregon University system, and they've done several studies now. We're entering the third iteration in which they've identified the value of predictability that the SIM level test has in terms of achievement in the college system.
But they still use the SAT and the...
They do, and I'd encourage you to talk with them directly, but the information that, as I recall from the report, is that the incremental variance or the amount of predictability above the Oregon statewide assessment was not significant in terms of the additional information from college placement tests.
No Child Left Behind?
Yes. Well, We're working on it. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done yet. Right now, we have a list of tasks that we yet have to complete in order to demonstrate our compliance. But we expect that to be achieved by the end of May.
Program evaluation?
At the systems level, yes. Per class, school.
Predictability of college success?
It wasn't. Yes, it has been used to do that.
Student electronic version, yes.
Yep. Yes.
And cost. Now, we had two different costs. One was we do have quite a cadre of employees dedicated to the state test.
Mm-hmm. Well, less than many states would have if they were doing the same.
Maybe we have.
We have, right, typically we have three content specialists who direct teachers in the item writing. We have a manager of psychometrics.
Total, how many FTE? I'm running out of time.
You are.
The chairman's going to take this away from me.
There's about 8 people working on the content, and then there's...
Would you provide cost for the panel, and would you... Could you give us the cost that you gave to Crummell's committee?
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And I'm sorry I didn't let you explain. I would have liked to have let you...
I appreciate that. And if there's another opportunity to come back and speak with you, I'd be more than happy to do that.
As bills are presented, and we're going to have public hearings on testing options and such, we'll have plenty of time between now and June 29th.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Now, Chair, can I just express my thanks to Representative Baum? Thank you, Representative Baum.
Excellent job. And just so that you know, we have not put out an agenda for next Tuesday yet. If we have a meeting, it will be an informational hearing at most. And so just that you're aware of that for your schedule purposes. With that, I close our hearing today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you all for bringing your laptops.